Blog Talk Radio.
Cue, everyone. Welcome to This Week in Health Innovation on the Blog Talk Radio Network. My name is Greg Masters. I'm the producer and co-host of the show. And This Week in Health Innovation is brought to you by Health Innovation Media, where we monitor and report on the digital health economy from idea to business model. And joining me in the virtual booth today from beautiful Marin County is my colleague and co-host, Dr. Phil Marshall. Phil, are you with us?
Yes, absolutely. Good to be talking with you and be with your audience today.
And we are very stoked as we have a mutual friend and colleague on the line with us today, hailing from, I'm not sure if he's in Boston, but that I believe is home. We're going to talk to Dr. Danny Sands. Danny, are you with us?
I am. Nice to see you, Greg. Or nice to hear you, Greg.
Great. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Danny Sands before I turn it over to Phil. Danny Sands is passionate about healthcare transformation, non-visit-based care, collaboration in healthcare, and participatory medicine. He spent 6 years at Cisco, most recently as Chief Medical Informatics Officer, where he provided both internal and external health IT leadership and helped key customers with business and clinical transformation using IT. Danny's prior position was CMIO at Zix Corporation, a leader in secure email and e-prescribing. And before that, he spent 13 years at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, where he developed and implemented numerous systems to improve clinical care delivery and patient engagement. Dr. Sands earned degrees from Boston Brown University, Ohio State University, the Harvard School of Public Health, and trained at Boston City Hospital and Boston's Beth Israel Hospital. Dr. Sands currently holds an academic appointment at Harvard Medical School and maintains a primary care practice in which he makes extensive use of health IT, much of which he helped to introduce during his tenure at Beth Israel Deaconess. Dr. Sands is the recipient of numerous health IT awards and has been elected to fellowship in both the American College of Physicians and the American College of Medical Informatics. He's a founder and co-chair of the board of the Society of Participatory Medicine and recently co-authored the book Let Patients Help with ePatient Dave. So with that as an abbreviated overview into Dr. Danny Sands, Phil, over to you.
Very good. Well, Dr. Sands, it's really good to have you with us on the show today. You are one of the biggest influencers, at least on the Twitterverse, when it comes to patient engagement and looking ahead in the market. You've described patient engagement as the blockbuster drug of the next century. And as we look at some of the enormous chess pieces that are moving in our healthcare system right now, from coverage to payment reform and accountable care, quality measurement, and now it seems as though there is either reemergence or greater emergence of patient engagement and patient involvement. Could you characterize how the next 10 years you would anticipate to be different than, let's say, the last 10 years or so, which have been characterized by meaningful use and electronic health records, among those other trends that I talked about? How will the next 10 years, do you think, be different?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Phil. It's a pleasure to be here, and you can certainly call me Danny. First of all, I want to correct one thing, and it was actually Leonard Kish who said patient engagement is the blockbuster drug of the 21st century. It is a great quote, however, a great statement, and I actually believe that the way we need to move as a healthcare system is patient engagement needs to be a key part of this. I would actually go beyond that and say this is not just about patient engagement, but it's really about patient and provider engagement, which is that they need to be engaging together. So historically, we've viewed healthcare as a system in which a patient gets sick, goes to a healthcare facility, and gets seen by healthcare providers, typically doctors, and gets treated. And it's actually quite a passive arrangement, if you think about it. And it's one in which the patient is not actively engaged, and the physician are often not actively engaged either. I think when we practice that way, we're sort of thinking about the kind of healthcare that the healthcare problems that we dealt with a century ago, which is where, you know, everything was an acute condition, and that there was no such thing as preventive health. There was no such thing as, you know, there weren't a lot of chronic conditions that we dealt with, because frankly, people died much younger. Today, people are living much longer, and you know, millions, tens of millions of Americans, for example, have chronic conditions. And we need to think differently about how we're going to practice healthcare in an age in which so many of our healthcare costs are going to treat chronic conditions, manage chronic conditions, and ideally prevent chronic conditions. The acute care system we have set up is not well suited to that. And even if we think about a healthcare system in which we have to have a healthcare system that manages these acute conditions, but we really have to think, you know, longitudinally. We have to think about how we're taking care of patients over a long period of time. And today's healthcare system is not well set up to do that. The relationship between the doctor and the patient, or the provider and the patient, or the provider's team and the patient, needs to be one of a collaboration. In healthcare, Phil, we've for a number of years, not for a long time, we've talked a lot about collaboration in healthcare. But we're talking about like collaboration among the doctors and nurses and other people who take care of the patient. But in fact, the patient is part of that collaboration. If we want to achieve good outcomes at low cost and high satisfaction, the patient needs to be part of that collaboration. So yeah, patient engagement needs to be a part of this, because we cannot sustain the healthcare system that we have today.
Oh, that's great. So then, as we look ahead, you would see that as an emerging topic. You know, recently, just a couple of weeks ago, the Health IT Policy Committee at HHS approved the Stage 3 Meaningful Use Workgroup recommendations, which explicitly now bless patient-generated health data and coming back into the electronic health record. Help us better get our mind around the domain of patient-generated health data and how that can come back in, influence, and be a part of the clinical setting. How will those two worlds either collide or merge harmoniously together?
Yeah, that's an important issue, an important piece of this. So when we think about patient collaboration, you know, patients being a part of the healthcare team, really. Part of that is just being informed and understand what's going on with your health. Ask questions. Be engaged. Be e-patients. Engaged, educated, enlightened, etc. So part of it is that, but part of it is actually sharing information as well. So it's not just about passively taking in information that's being thrown at you, but it's about providing your own information about you. Both providers and patients are bringing something to the table, and one of the things the patient is bringing is expertise about themselves. But another thing they're bringing in is they're bringing in something about what's going on with them on a day-to-day basis. When Tom Ferguson, who is one of my mentors, Tom Ferguson, he sort of created this term e-patient, and he observed that when we think about healthcare. When we talk about healthcare from the healthcare provider's perspective, all we talk about is primary care, secondary care, and tertiary care. And we forget that there's so much more that's going on that is outside the purview of professional healthcare. And by the way, all that other stuff is really important stuff. And he proposed that we actually turn the whole thing on its head and instead really encourage patient self-care and patients reaching out to other patients and friends and families and so on, and then getting to the point of collaboration with their healthcare providers, and only in some cases getting to the point where the provider, the physician, is the expert. So is the authority, I should say. So as part of that model, if we think that really healthcare is what takes place in between encounters with the healthcare system. So I would argue that point, that no matter what happens outside of, you know, acute conditions, you know, you're sick, you need surgery, whatever, healthcare is what happens in between episodes in which you're in contact with the healthcare system. So if you think about that, we should not be just acquiring data when we see you every 3 months or 6 months or 12 months or 24 months. We should be continuously gathering data from you to help you stay well and help you from getting sicker if you're already sick. And it's fascinating. I'm sorry, go on.
No, right, go ahead. No, I have a question.
So if you think about you know, diseases that we commonly care about, chronic conditions that are really in epidemics right now, you know, we talk about things like congestive heart failure and diabetes, hypertension. Let's just take hypertension as an example, since it's so common and many of our listeners probably may have this condition or know someone who has this condition. We assess how well we know that elevated blood pressure over a prolonged period of time leads to complications. It leads down the line to an increased risk of stroke, kidney failure, heart attack, congestive heart failure, and so on. And yet the way we assess how well we're doing at managing this is by checking someone's blood pressure in the office every 6 months. But really that doesn't make sense, because we're going to be artificially lulled into a sense of security if we get a normal blood pressure reading, but it might be that the patient's blood pressure is high a lot of the time, and when they come into the office it's lower, or the other way around often happens too, where a patient's blood pressure is higher in the office and it's lower when they're not in the office, and we can cause harm that way as well. So we need to be thinking about frequent small touches with patients, through which we exchange information, whether it's, you know, blood pressure measuring or it's symptoms or it's whatever. That's the model of healthcare we need to move to, and we need systems that support that.
So the health happens between visits, with frequent small touches being what we need to do. But if you're a clinician listening to the show today, and you're, you know, you're practicing medicine, you're sort of in a normal scenario where you've got an electronic health record system, you've got 15, 20, maybe even more patients a day that you're that you've got scheduled. Most of them sort of routine returns, some of them acute issues that need to be dealt with. And you're saying to yourself, wait a minute, I'm already seeing patients as fast as I can. I'm already burdened with data entry, with the electronic health record. I'm already getting these alerts. I'm getting letters from the health plans. I'm getting billing concerns being brought up in addition to having to manage the clinical state of my patients. How in the world should I, as a clinician, think about how in the world I could possibly take on this additional process of managing or even being aware of or responding to an ongoing data stream from my patients? How does my practice need to think about that in the future, and how in the world could I possibly manage it?
So you're absolutely right. This is the biggest challenge that we have, is that we don't have systems in place to help us with where we need to go. And we have physicians that are like hamsters on a treadmill, sort of running as fast as they can, particularly in things like primary care. Well, we can't get, and that's what I practice, and we can't get done everything that needs to be done today, and we can't even step back and think about what's wrong with this picture. And we don't have electronic medical records that would deal with this well. We don't have teams set up to deal with this well. Now, there are places, though, where they're doing some very innovative things in this area. If you look at the way many of the VA practices are set up, if you look at the way Kaiser is set up, Geisinger, there are a lot of innovative practices that are doing things differently. They're thinking differently about this, both in terms of the structure of their teams as well as their payment models. So today, our payment model is based on this acute care, this episodic care, we'll call it. So we got to come in and get paid. So as a doctor, if you want to, you know, put the food on your table and send your kids to college, whatever, what you've got to do is you've got to see as many patients as you can. You've got to do more stuff to more people in less time. That's the way the system works right now. But we're moving to a model of care through accountable care organizations, patient-centered medical homes, and other similar sorts of pay-for-value arrangements, in which we are being held responsible for keeping costs down and maintaining a high level of quality in the care we deliver. And so it's kind of interesting. It's very hard, by the way, as a provider or a provider organization like a hospital healthcare system to make this transition. And I think there's going to be a lot of pain and suffering among the providers as they go through this transition. But if you could actually step back and think, well, if I'm really paid differently, then how am I going to provide care differently? How are my systems going to be different? How is my staffing going to be different? What am I going to do differently? And it's hard for us to think like that as providers because we've been doing things the same way more or less for such a long time. So we must think differently about it. We've got to think differently about staffing. And by the way, many of the patients who we're seeing in the office today don't need to be in the office today. We're seeing them in the office today because that's the way we get paid as doctors. Okay, we're getting paid for those patients coming into the office. But that doesn't make any sense. You know, if a patient is having – so I discovered many years ago, when I started seeing patients at Beth Israel in 1991, I was working in an organization, one of the first hospitals in the country that used email. And I rapidly started using email with my patients, which led to me co-authoring the very first guidelines for how to use email with patients in 1998. But the point is, one of the benefits of that is that I could take care of patients using this technology, which I would argue is pretty low tech at this point. Then it was high tech. This technology can actually keep people out of the office. Because rather than having patients come into the office for absolutely everything, I can take care of them asynchronously and remotely. A patient has a recurrence of a symptom that they've had before. You know, do I need to come into this? Can you just treat me? I'll treat you. You know, ideally the telephone can be used like that too, but the telephone is an interruptive medium, and it's challenging to get it to work. Email is an option, though. Telephone is good. Email is an option. Video conferencing with patients or chat is an option. All these things are ways that we can more cost-effectively take care of patients and keep our offices more empty for the patients who really need to be there. We can't accommodate the people who really need those face-to-face visits today because we have too many patients in our offices who don't need to be there. In many communities and in many countries I've visited, the state of the practice is that if you as a patient come into my office and you get a test done, the only way to get that test result is to come into the office and get it. Crazy, right?
It is crazy if you ask me, and I know that you've been part of a group of folks. I was involved somewhat as well in making sure that patients do have the right to get their lab test results themselves if they so choose. But this is a fascinating topic. Let's look back now. The last 10 years where email or secure email has become more pervasive in healthcare. Back in 1998 when you published that paper, the challenge that you faced, I'm sure, was that people said, how am I going to get paid for that, right? Because after all, it was going to remove patients from my practice. Now, as best I can tell, over the last 10 to 15 years where secure email has become more pervasive, doctors' practices haven't emptied out. They've been scratching their heads how to fill their day. But I'm wondering if maybe you could say, okay, 15 years ago you were asked, how am I going to get paid if I'm having email with my patients? What would you he's looking back on that was sort of the rationale, or what was what's been the response in the fact that the doctors aren't getting paid for each email?
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing is not all that much has changed in 15 years, or actually 16 years, but not all that much has changed. So when I talk to physicians about this, and I talk to groups of physicians all the time, the number one question is, how do I get paid for this, still today? And if you look at numbers, although the overall proportion of physicians who have used email with patients has gone up, And largely that's due to large physician organizations like Kaiser that have all of their physicians using it. It's mandatory. But still, there's a huge amount of resistance among physicians. That despite the fact that meaningful use stage two, to achieve that, you have to be communicating with your patients electronically. But we can talk more about that later. So there's still a lot of resistance. Physicians are still trying to figure out how to bill for this as a service, and we have more people using it, but the proportion of physicians who are regularly using this is still pretty modest, and that's just got to change. And this is low tech. I mean, if for any of our listeners who have teenage kids, they don't even use email anymore. I mean, they're on to other modes of messaging. Email is for adults and for formal things. So we need to just think differently about this whole thing. Email is just a symptom of this. When I talk to physicians about patient engagement, about sharing information with them, education, they say, well, how am I going to get paid for that? And this is just the wrong mindset, and this is why I think our payment model really doesn't support the kind of care that we need to be delivering. So healthcare system in the U.S., we're working at cross purposes to the goals we're trying to solve.
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic. Even 15 years ago, the question, you know, how am I going to get paid for this, was sort of met by some, like Kaiser, with a response of, well, let's focus on seeing the patients that need to be seen and handling those non-urgent issues in this other less onerous way. But let's look ahead now. So if email is for grandma, let's look ahead to what the rest of us or the younger generations are going to be looking to over the next 10 years. So there's a lot happening out in the direct-to-consumer space with regard to wearables. There's other interactive technologies that are emerging. We talked a little bit about how patient-generated data might be able to come back into the clinical setting, having those frequent small touches with patients in an ongoing way could help the practice of medicine. But what are you seeing right now out there that excites you most about what consumers might use wearables? Is it Apple HealthBook? Is it other things that you're seeing? What excites you most about what's going to help to bridge this gap in helping patients to participate in a more ongoing way with their care?
Phil, there's a lot of frothiness and perhaps. Irrational exuberance around so many technologies in healthcare, and this has been going on despite the collapse of the industry essentially around the year 2000. So when I go to conferences and you see a lot of these young startups and they got a lot of energy, and I'm struck by the fact that some of the founders of these companies really don't really understand the healthcare system and certainly don't understand the economics of it. So I can't point to a technology that I think is going to make a huge difference. I think email, if it were used widely, or asynchronous communication of some sort, secure email through a portal, I think that is a simple technology that can make a huge difference. And so that's an example of something, and it's not glitzy, and it's not glamorous, and it's today fairly low tech, but it is important. I think that care at a distance, I think, is important. There are lots of different ways we can provide care at a distance. Everything, so email is actually one way we can do that. Real-time online chats, video conferencing are some of the ways. Home monitoring, remote monitoring is another way we can do this. So there are a lot of different things we can we can do to provide care at a distance. And I think that when you think about it, the patient providing information is really important. Now, what's really exciting is that so many of the ways that patients have been gathering information before has been through written logs. And there's not a single physician who takes care of patients with diabetes who doesn't have stories about patients bringing their written blood sugar measurements each day, and they're bringing them in handwritten. You can barely read the things, blood stains on the piece of paper. I mean, it's unbelievable. But now we have connected devices, and at one level, just having that connected device, I think, makes a huge difference, because now all this information from my glucometer gets automatically uploaded to an app or to a website. And I think in the future, that's information that's going to be fed back to the practices who are working with the patient to control their diabetes. So I think the advent of connected... go on.
I was going to say, in fact, last week we talked with Dr. David Albert, who invented the AliveCor EKG on the iPhone. And so whether it's glucometers, it's blood pressure, it's EKG readings, in increasing volumes of structured data being collected in these clinical populations, there's, again, coming back to the concern, how would a clinician sort of be able to siphon through all that data and decipher the signal from the noise? I mean, how do these devices, whether it's those that we mentioned or even Fitbits, Jawbones, Fuel Bands, are they going to need to basically surface the critical points that a clinician might interact with? I mean, how are we going to get beyond the sort of signal-to-noise ratio?
So I think that one of the interesting things that I've observed is that so many of the people who are using, devices, activity monitoring devices, are the people who don't need them. So, people who are athletes, people who exercise every day, and I think that's great, but that's not helping, improve the public's health. And what we need to do is we need to engage patients using these devices who really need it, the people who are sickest. And I think that thinking about who's going to actually use these devices, how is it going to work into their day, what's their workflow, and then what's the workflow if the information comes back to healthcare providers, what are we going to do there? So part of the answer to that second thing is raw data is not going to be helpful. We need to develop algorithms that look at the data, identify trends, and point us to things that are important for us to know, whether it's glucose measurements or weights or blood pressures or whatever, because there will be an overload of data. So we need programs that are going to filter this out, improve the signal-to-noise ratio. But again, we need people using these devices who really need to be using these devices. That's where it's really going to make a difference. In my practice, I've actually started prescribing, and I put that in quotes because health plans don't pay for it, prescribing Fitbits to some of my patients who need a little extra motivation to exercise. And it's just an experiment in my own practice. We'll see what happens, because these are not people who are athletes or otherwise motivated. But in this case, the data is not coming in to me. They're going to share this information with me through electronic messages, secure messaging, or they're going to bring it in with them to the visits. But I really want to see if it impacts their behavior.
Excellent. Well, that's very forward thinking, and maybe as payment reform rules along, there will be an opportunity to support that kind of device prescription. So as we look ahead to the next minute of our interview, which is what we've got left, what are some words of advice that you would give to clinicians out there to help them anticipate what is coming down the road and how to manage the more digitally connected consumer?
Clinicians need to think differently about how we work with patients. Healthcare is not a spectator sport, it's a participatory sport. And the sooner they do that, the sooner they're going to be getting better outcomes, improving satisfaction for both the patients and for them as well, not to mention the family caregivers. And they're going to have to increasingly engage the patients also in sharing data with them in different ways. And they should also not worry about bringing patients into the office every time because, as you pointed out, not everybody needs to be in the office, and there's a waiting list of people to get in everybody's office. So I think the physician needs to take a breath, step back, not be afraid, and just think about how they're going to incorporate this into their practices.
Well, that's wonderful, Danny. Much healthcare is not a spectator sport. Yet another tweetable phrase from Dr. Danny Sands. And we thank you so much for joining us this week. Safe travels, what great words of advice as we look ahead to the next generation of patient connectivity.
Thank you, Phil.
And that'll have to be the last word. There you go. I echo the sentiment that healthcare is not a spectator sport. We've been listening to an interview with Dr. Danny Sands. Follow him on Twitter at drdanny, DannySands. And check him out on the web as well, drdannysands.com. We do this weekly on This Week in Health Innovation. I want to thank my co-host, Dr. Phil Marshall, for his time today. And Danny, be well. See you at the next conference. Greg Master saying, bye now. People couldn't believe what I've become.